does your administration stand in regards to this alleged monster? Is he a menace or a miracle?
Gonna step up to the microphone. Say it loud and clear. A better day is coming soon to get us out of here.
Welcome to PID Radio. I'm Derek Gilbert.
And I'm Sharon Gilbert, and I am so excited. Two amazing things have entered our home.
Yes, on this Thursday, March 23rd of 2006. Number one,
the gazelle.
Oh, yes, the gazelle.
The gazelle.
I was thinking that box of, that bag of cheesy poops over there.
Well, that's pretty exciting. That is
no,
exciting.
The gazelle is really cool.
The gazelle.
Cool.
We got the, you've seen the ads with Tony Little. We got a gazelle for the bunker, and that way, no matter what, I can still get my exercise. One of these days, I'm going to get on that gazelle. No, actually, I got it on tonight. So Derek and I have just spent the last hour putting this together, which is why everything's going to be just slightly later than it normally would
be. Yeah, it's a little past 8 bunker standard time, yeah. But that's not that much later.
No, not a whole lot later. But you know what? It was a nice couple time. Mm-hmm. And we actually work well together.
We do. We do. Even with tools.
Which is really frightening.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have my own tool set. It's a...
That's right.
Do it herself. That yeah. I bought when I was a student living alone back in Bloomington, and and Derek avoids using it whenever possible.
Well, it wasn't that. It's just I knew where my screwdriver was in the toolbox.
I know, honey. It's okay. I don't mind. At least it's not pink.
Yeah, well,
the
I was going to say.
The ones that they make now
right.
are pink. This one's at least blue.
Yeah,
but so the other thing that's new in the bunker house is your book.
That's right. Yeah. We got the proof copy of Iron Dragons, my first novel, which is it's what I wrote for the National Novel Writing Month in, was it 02 or 04 when we did the first one?
It was the
02. Yeah.
02. You did not finish it in November.
No, it took
me. You finished it later on in the spring, but you did complete it, which I think is wonderful.
Well, it's kind of a fun novel in that it doesn't. Well, it's not about the kind of things that we talk about here. The follow-up, not follow-up, but novels that I've been working on since then, one completed and two or three started,
mm-hmm.
are more conspiratorial in nature. But Iron Dragons was inspired by you because you came up with the opening line, which was like...
I came up with
whoa.
The title, too.
And the title. The title and the opening line.
I gave him a title and an opening line, and I said, it's all yours. Go at it.
Yeah.
And he wrote this wonderful, wonderful book.
Well, it was fun to do, and it was different for me because I've never really been into science. Well, science fiction I like, but fantasy novels I don't.
I know, but you wrote a great one.
Well, thank you, sweetheart.
Mm-hmm.
It is a take on fantasy novels in that it does include dragons, but from a science fiction perspective. Now, of course, I had to bend science around a lot in order to do it, but basically the premise is that there is a world in which dragons exist. And on which a group of men have the power to do battle with them on their own terms, mm-hmm. but their power is rooted in control of a power that we are very familiar with, mm-hmm. electromagnetic energy.
This is a great alternative to some of the other fantasy novels out there that preteens and teenage kids are reading.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, adults should read this too. It's a great for any age pretty much, but we do know for sure that preteen and teenage boys love this book.
Well, Nicole has been telling us. In fact, I did some readings from this book while I was still working on it when Nicole was in seventh grade.
Mm-hmm.
And the class, well, she reported later that they were wanting to know what happened because I only read mm-hmm. the first two chapters, which includes the first battle with the dragon. They mm-hmm. get into the action pretty quickly, and they were demanding to know when it was going to be out.
Yeah.
Well, here it is. Almost 4 years later.
I know. And this is a book that your dad wanted out. He read it and loved it. So, you know what? This is for you, Pablo.
Yeah.
And you can tell that I'm a pretty proud wife. I'm so excited that this book is out there. But anyway, to the news.
Yes, before we finish our interview with Janet Phelan on what she calls the Public Extermination Project, Charlie Sheen is in the news, which was a bit surprising. Charlie Sheen did an interview with Alex Jones on Genesis Communications Network earlier this week, in which he flat out said that he doesn't buy the government's story on 9/11.
Hmm.
That he doesn't believe that the airplanes took down the towers or that it was a 757 that hit the Pentagon, as we've been told. To which most of you listening probably say, well, no, duh.
Mm-hmm.
But for someone who's in the public eye like Charlie Sheen to publicly come out and say so and to give credence to Alex Jones by appearing on his program to say so is a... This is huge. It's a big change.
It is really, really big.
Yeah. In fact, last night, the folks at CNN who do their Showbiz Tonight program apparently did a feature on this. And hear that they referred to Alex Jones as fringe journalist, fringe talk show host. But they interviewed some people about this. They interviewed one of the fellows connected to the 911truth.org website.
Mm-hmm.
And they also brought in the producer for the National Geographic 9/11 special. You know,
yes.
The one that validated the government story.
Yeah.
Nothing to see here. Move along. And, you know, it was, well, it's very interesting to see what's going to happen here. I haven't looked around the web yet to see if the likes of, say, Ann Coulter and Michelle Malkin are lining up to tear Charlie a new one. But, it will be interesting to see how the reaction plays out to this,
mm-hmm.
or if they just drop it and let it go and pretend that it never happened. But because as well known as Alex Jones is among those of us who try to look a little deeper
mm-hmm.
for answers, and he does some good work. He's a little bombastic at times, you know, like almost mm-hmm. like an alternative Rush Limbaugh.
Yeah, but you know what? We've learned a lot from Alex.
We really have. And
we have listened to his show, read his stuff, watched his videos.
Even subscribed for a while and downloaded some of the videos and watched his videos on the web. It is a big change for someone who is considered mainstream, like Charlie Sheen, to give any credibility to someone like Alex Jones by appearing on his program. So I think this is a big deal, and we'll wait to see how this plays out.
Yeah, Charlie, come on our show.
That's right. Yeah, we'll. We've even seen some of his movies he'd like to forget.
Yeah.
I do like Charlie Sheen as an actor.
I do, too. I like the little walk-on he does in Ferris Bueller. Remember, he's the kid, the teenage boy or the young boy who's at the police station when Ferris's older sister is... being held there.
Uh-huh. I'd forgotten that he was in that.
Well, actually, she's a witness because Jeffrey Jones' character, the principal,
right,
has broken into the house, if you remember all that. Yeah, he was sitting there, and he sort of was the cool guy that helped her break out of her shell.
Uh-huh. Okay. I'd forgotten all about that. Yeah. Well, anyway, onward and upward, the military writer for the Washington Post, William Arkin, reports that the United States is building new bases in the Middle East. Looks
well,
like we're going to be there for a while. Yeah.
Yeah, and that was on Fox News today, by the way.
Oh, they did?
Someone
okay.
said something about whether or not we're going to have success in Iraq. And I honestly was doing something else at the time, so I can't tell you who it was, but I heard someone say, well, we're building permanent bases there, so I think that we're there for the long haul. And I thought... they are actually on Fox coming out and saying, because mm-hmm. we've been saying this for a couple of weeks, that
yep.
there is the story that we are building super bases, permanent bases, with movie theaters and
right.
coffee shops and the kind of permanent bases you'd see here.
Right. But this is even going beyond that. This is part of a 10-year plan for deep storage of equipment and munitions in 6 Middle Eastern countries to prepare for future contingencies mm-hmm. in the region.
This is
a way for us to build a base in a country where the people might not like us being there, might mm-hmm. not like the Americans being there, without actually being there. Basically, we will have stuff ready to go, meals ready to eat, mm-hmm. you know, weaponry, equipment under lock and key. And
it's Operation Chipmunk, I think is what it is.
Yeah, exactly.
Because
yeah,
a chipmunk will have several dens.
Mm-hmm.
and several entrances back doors. And the chipmunk will also have stashes all over the place.
Yeah, that's basically what it is. It's Operation Chipmunk in the Middle East. And in addition to storing material and food in Bahrain, Kuwait, Qatar, and Oman, there will be two new storage hubs set up, one in a Central Asian country that has yet to be decided, possibly Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, somewhere there, maybe even Afghanistan, and one in a classified, this is the one that's interesting. Arkin reports that the 10th site will be in a classified Middle Eastern country west of Saudi Arabia called Site 23. Now, Middle Eastern countries west of Saudi Arabia are pretty few in number. I mean, that basically limits it to Jordan or Israel, or possibly Lebanon or Syria, but Syria is more north.
Yeah, it is. If you're going to go directly west, then...
Or Egypt, if you want to count Egypt.
I don't know if that's...
Sudan? Sudan's not exactly Middle East, but it's due south of Egypt.
Well, that's a good point.
Ethiopia, Eritrea? Where could that sixth country be?
I don't know. That's a really good question.
Hmm.
Well, we did build that base in Israel that supposedly, according to Chamish, really did become a UN or an Israeli base. Mm-hmm. Depends on who you ask.
Well,
but I don't know.
I suspect we've got stuff stored there, or at least stuff that we can borrow if we need it.
Well, exactly. Why would we send our men and women over there to build it when we weren't going to run it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, speaking of supplies, it looks like if you want to make sure they have plenty of water, you better snab it. That's a good word.
Snap it? Yeah.
Yeah, snab it. No, snab. No.
Oh.
You better, it's like snatch and grab.
Ah.
You better get it now because it looks like the World Conference is getting together and they said, you know what? We don't think that humans have a basic right to water.
Huh.
I predict the water will be sold one day.
Well, this is what we were...
I mean, it's being sold now. We have to pay the water company for water. But, I mean, you just won't be able to get it for free.
Right. We've talked about this, and I think you're right, that water is going to become the big commodity of the 21st century. Mm-hmm. And, of course, water and how it's distributed is basically those who have the power to distribute and ration water to others basically holds their lives in his hands.
Mm-hmm.
I did a little digging, by the way, when you know, because we've been talking about water this week and how the government may be, in certain cities, may be undertaking plans to manipulate the water supply without really telling us what they're doing for purposes unknown. Our water here in St. Louis is not purified or distributed to us by the municipality. It's not even owned by a local company, even though the name sounds local. Our company here is Missouri American Water.
Mm-hmm.
It's a subsidiary of a company called American Water, which operates in 19 states here in the U.S. American Water is itself a subsidiary of a German company, RWE Group, which... well, was formed back in 1898. It's been around a long time.
It's probably the same company that owns Aldi.
Well, they have a lot. They hold a lot of different companies. They also have a water division in England, and they also operate power plants and the electric grid in Germany. They were in charge of the German electric grid during World War II. They integrated it with the electric grids of other nations under Nazi control during World War II. In order to keep power flowing to the war machine there. And I did a little digging into it and found that they were connected, at least in a small way, but they were connected to Fritz Thyssen, who was one of the big industrialists in the German war machine in the 1930s and 40s.
Well, you know, I can go further than that. Remember we had a story on Watcher Magazine, and I'm trying to find the date. The story goes back to... I think it was last fall or something. I don't see the date on here. But the story is, will local government be privatized? East Riding of Yorkshire in England.
Right, right.
Is now being run by Germany.
That's
by
right.
A German
I remember
company.
That story. I remember that story.
And there was also another one that's being run by France. English counties become part of France. Remember that?
Yeah, yeah.
Hampshire and West Sussex.
Huh.
Yeah, it's almost like... Well, in fact, there is a town around here, too. There are towns in the United States, generally really small ones, that sell themselves out to the highest bidder on eBay. Seriously. You can sell anything. But here's the notion of not just businesses, but municipalities
right.
selling out to a foreign investor.
Well, like we talked about, the rights to operate the Indiana Toll Road being leased for 99 years to a Spanish and Australian concern. Mm-hmm. The same company runs the Chicago Toll, the Chicago Skyway, and we're seeing other situations that we've talked about, like a Russian company wanting to come in and operate gas stations to the Northeast. Basically, what we're seeing is the one world government being implemented through commerce rather than through...
Well, I've heard that said, that in fact we do have one world now.
Yeah, it's an oligarchy. Yeah,
exactly. It's economic.
Uh-huh.
If you think that you are not touched by what goes on across the world, then you are living in a dreamland.
Or just in years gone by.
Yeah.
And that may be why the United States government didn't raise any kind of a fuss when certain key industries have basically been allowed to decay to the point where we can't do things here anymore that we need done.
That could be.
You know, just in our business, in steel pipe, there are certain kinds of pipe that are needed for the high-pressure steam lines inside power plants. That's pretty strategic. And we will occasionally get inquiries from utility companies that want this grade of pipe must be domestic maker or must be a domestic mill. And we have to tell them, well, then you're not going to get what you want mm-hmm. because there ain't any domestic mills that make this anymore.
You know, along the same line is a story that's also on Watcher Today about the Ottawa wanting to start buying, they want to start buying Russian natural gas.
Right.
The liquefied natural gas, and they're going to sell it to the United States. You know, if you think oil and gas, gasoline for your car, is a big problem,
mm-hmm.
a lot of homes are heated by natural gas. A lot of companies are heated
right.
by natural gas. It's one thing not to be able to drive your car to work. It's another thing not to be able to heat your home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that is...
Or cook.
We've been thankful.
We have a natural gas stove.
Right. And thankfully, we've had a relatively mild winter across the United States. In fact, the worst part of it seems to have been within the last 2-3 weeks. So it was not as bad as it might have been. But when natural gas is in short supply and the temperatures drop, it could be mm-hmm. it could be ugly.
I think
then
the
Canadians will have us in their grasp.
I think the Northeast had some tough times this winter. They had a lot of cold weather.
A lot of cold and a lot of snow, and
yeah.
again, especially in the last few weeks.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we could heat things up quite a bit if the activity under Yellowstone finally comes to a head. European satellites have reported that in satellite passes over Yellowstone, the supervolcano, the caldera there, the magma movement underneath the caldera seems to have pushed up the center of an area on the northern edge of the caldera by as much as 6 inches.
In how long?
Within about 6 years.
That's a lot.
Yeah. Several satellite passes from 1996 through the year 2000, and the image shows an uplift of about 125 millimeters, which is about 6 inches.
That is a lot.
That is a lot, yeah. So, in fact, Stan Dale posted an article about this to his website, and it is it also makes reference to the Norris Geyser Basin mm-hmm. region, in which ground temperatures there got so hot that vegetation was basically dying.
Well, I think the Norris area is where there was more than vegetation dying. It was getting so hot that they thought that may have contributed to the death of, was it moose that were dying there?
I think you're right, yeah. But things are getting a little dicey there, and we'll put a link to this in the show notes because that's kind of a big deal. Not only is this area rising, but then other areas are sinking as the magma apparently flows from underneath those areas into this one area where it's rising. And we'll definitely put the picture in the show notes because it's pretty spectacular.
You know, there's a really...
it's like a boil.
Oh, that's bad. There's a really well-done docudrama that's, I think it was a British one.
Yeah.
That came out about Yellowstone. Mm-hmm. And if you haven't seen it, what was that? Was that on the History Channel or
Discovery
Channel? Yeah, we'll have to see if there's a copy of that available. That's a really, really good show. Boy,
it was well done.
Makes you think, too.
Yeah, really well done. Well, we need to get on to
part three.
Yes, Janet Phelan, who has really laid it on the line to bring this story to the public.
Yeah, she really has.
Is continuing to investigate as more information becomes available. In talking with her, she's not claiming to have all the answers here. Mm-hmm. So we encourage
to her credit.
To her credit, right. Listen, consider the evidence, and give it serious thought. And I keep coming back myself to the runaround that she was getting from the Department of Water and Power in Los Angeles about these valves and why they were being used. You know, denials that the valves were even being used. Mm-hmm. When she had pictures of them out in the street. Why? Why? Does she look like a terrorist who might be trying to do something with the water supply?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. You know, and I think Janet herself would be one of the first people to try to find other explanations for this. She does not want to really, deep down in her heart, believe that there's something, you know, sinister going on. But she has questions, and I think raising the questions is perfectly legitimate.
Mm-hmm. So with no further ado, part three of our interview with Janet Phelan on the Public Extermination Project.
Now, Janet, you mentioned something yesterday that we didn't expand on, and I think we probably ought to go there next, and that is the connections between the public works projects that you've been talking about, which has kind of been, if I understand correctly, going on in sort of a, you know, below the background noise for quite some time. But the connection between the modifications to the water delivery system and the Iraq War, that is intriguing. Can you tell us why you think those issues are connected?
Yes. The Iraqi War has massively destabilized that region, and with threats going on concerning our invasion of Iran, you know, and a lot of actions of Israel, which has been mounting antipathy towards Israel, we are seeing again the turning on the taps worldwide of anti-Semitism.
Hmm.
Now, if, and I'm positing this as a question, if we are in fact facing another Hitlerian push, if Jews would be one of the target groups for this system, then it would be necessary to expunge Israel. Israel is the safety net, supposedly, for world Jews. It was established after Hitler's war, World War II, as a safety net for Jews. So if Jews would again be targeted, they would flee to Israel, would they not? Mm-hmm. However, if Israel gets hit, if this Osama bin Laden, who we can't find because we don't want to, because he's apparently, you know, set up by the CIA as the straw man, the fall guy here,
mm-hmm.
if quote-unquote Osama bin Laden lobs one over at Israel, and with all the destabilization going on in the region, if Israel gets demolished, then there won't be a safety net.
Mm-hmm.
And if Jews are one of the groups that will be targeted for this, and I have very good reason to believe that that is so, then the expungement of Israel would remove any possibility for refuge.
Hmm. That is a chilling thought. It's almost as though they've been pushed into one convenient location.
That's the Zionist agenda to
right.
do that, isn't it?
Well, yeah, and it has been even before World War II.
Mm-hmm.
There were elements within European Jewry and here in the United States to encourage the return of Jews worldwide to a nation state of Israel. And right now we are pushing for a confrontation with Iran, it seems.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, anything that happens there that would involve the United States and Iran is certainly going to involve Israel as well.
Mm-hmm. You know, personally, I think that there are many groups that will be targeted by the system. A friend of mine in L.A. who's Jewish and a writer said something to me that I found very, very resonant. And he said, anybody who will sell out his brother for his own safety gets to sit at the table. And in that sense, we're talking about a spiritual crisis. And we're not necessarily only restricted to understanding what is going on in the Middle East as a political war. I believe it is also a spiritual war, and I believe that those who are standing up in any faith, in any religious understanding, whether they are Jews, whether they are Christians, whether they are Muslims, if they are acting out of decency and love and concern for others, they are in trouble. And that is spiritual warfare, is it not?
It is, but you know what? They can't do a whole lot with my body. You know, let them take my body. But I've still got, you know, eternity. We have a good friend who's a Christian. And he says, you know, what's the worst thing you can do to me? Send me straight to heaven? He just laughs at it. And I know it's easy to sit here in the comfort of our homes and say, you know, we'd stand up for this or we'd stand up for that. But I really do think that when it comes down to it, you're right. I think this is going to be a big dividing line. Are you willing to turn in your neighbor? Are you willing to shelter your neighbor? And that was obvious in World War II. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of people who sheltered Jews, mm-hmm. you know, hid them out in their attics or in little makeshift rooms between walls.
And the students of End Times Prophecy will see that there is definitely an apocalyptic component here as well, which this system may play into.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't take the mark, you don't get water.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you don't take the mark, you get water plus.
Right.
Well, something else interesting in prophecy about this is in Revelations, the talk about wormwood and how comet wormwood hits the planet and the waters become bitter, mm-hmm. and one-third of the people die.
Right.
That's something that hadn't occurred to me. That's very...
That's very astute. There are a couple of different judgments on water. One is on the seas, and all mm-hmm. the third of the life in the seas turned to blood. And then there's judgment upon the fresh water, the drinkable water. And water, you know, I've heard so many people say, you know what, if it comes to the end times and push comes to shove, I want to make sure that I have my gun and lots of gold. Well, those may be very important things at the time, but I think when it comes right down to it, water is going to be the important thing.
And, you know, we've been noting the movement of American troops in South America along the border of Paraguay and Bolivia,
mm-hmm.
which just happens to border on one of the largest freshwater aquifers in the world.
Exactly.
And one speculates, while everyone's attention is focused on the Middle East, why we have operatives working in that area, and why, interestingly enough, a lot of property in that area is in the hands and under the control of the Reverend Sun Myung Moon,
mm-hmm.
who is very tightly connected to very powerful conservative and neocon politicians in Washington, D.C. Your research and what you've discovered, Janet, kind of puts a whole new spin on this drive to control fresh water sources
mm-hmm.
in the world.
You know, in the Middle East, it used to be that it was the water, the wells that they fought over. Not the oil wells, but the water wells.
And control of, the Jordan River and, you know, in Israel
mm-hmm.
is a big source of bone of contention between Israel, Syria, Lebanon.
See, oil is money, but water is life.
Mm-hmm.
And my understanding is that those in power now, they've got a lot of money. They're pushing for measures that bespeak an enormous desire for power and control. And to control water does control life on this planet.
Yeah.
You know, there's another bit of legislation that's out there that factors into this. Apparently, if Derek and I lived on a farm and we had a well, our water would have to pass muster before we could use it. In other words, we couldn't just say we're happy with it. Now, every bit of water on your land has to pass rigorous inspection now.
Mm-hmm. In fact, even water collected in rain barrels.
Mm-hmm. And it used to be when I was a kid, we collected water in rain barrels all the time. You know, every downspout around our house, I was raised in the country, had a water barrel, and we drank it because we didn't have city water.
Yeah, and that is something that the EPA has been pushing for. And I don't know enough about it to know if this is a national EPA push or if this is on a state-by-state basis. But we've heard the radio broadcaster, Derry Brownfield, talk about that. And, of course, being a farmer himself for many years, he's much more in tune with those kinds of issues. Getting back to one other thing, and I just want to, you know, for my own curiosity now, delve a little bit more into the time scale that we're working with here. And again, just to reinforce the idea to the listeners that this is not something that's brand new, not something that's been going on just since 2001, that this is a project that's been going on for quite some time. What sources did you have, or what documentation, or how did you find out that this goes back 20, 30 years, these retrofitting projects?
In Los Angeles, it is a matter of record, and the engineers are very free to discuss that they have been working on the cement relining project, which is also the putting in the remote control valve.
Okay.
Parenthetically, they're very, you know, free to discuss that. It's been going on for decades. Also, according to one of my technical advisors, who is an engineer and has worked on government projects in the past, although certainly not now, he is stating that the technology to actually accomplish this was in place in 1975. So
that's
it has to do with integrated circuits, et cetera, and some, you know, the electronic aspects of it.
Yeah. Well,
so
that's pretty interesting.
Like, as soon as they got the technology, they just went full speed ahead.
Well, yeah, because the state of home computing, or personal computing anyway, in the mid-70s was, about the level of Commodore 64? one would say or suggest that having the ability to remotely control valves, water valves, is just an efficiency move by the water department. I mean, anytime a home changes hands or sits vacant for a while, somebody needs to come out and shut off the water. And I know that in our area, just outside St. Louis, they have to do it manually. We've got a little access pipe that comes up through the front yard lawn. We've ruined several lawnmower blades on it. That they have to go down into it with a tool to manually turn on and turn off the water.
Right.
So being able to do this, from a central control point by you know, punching in a command into a computer would be a matter of efficiency.
Yes, it certainly would be, but I will say again, look at the first photograph on that website.
Mm-hmm.
We have a system with four ports,
mm-hmm.
and a valve is obviously attached to one of those ports. Now, if we only have a shut-on and shut-off system, you don't need four ports.
Right, you just need three, like a T. You've got a run.
Well, you just may actually even need, you know, two. I mean, the water coming in and then stopping it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So a T or simply a gate,
right,
on and off. You don't need four ports.
And again, the disturbing thing that you discovered was the existence of the second line parallel to the existing water line on those blueprints. And the existence of the second line, if they're replacing the first line with the cement relining project, the second line is obviously
redundant.
It's redundant, and it's
redundant, exactly. Now, one of the bring up one other thing about these blueprints. When I was in Ali Sabuni's office last week, and I do have this entire conversation on tape, I was looking. His blueprints are stuck up on his wall. I mean, the entire wall is blueprints. And I was pointing out some things and asking him questions, which he was attempting to answer inaudibly. And one of the streets, he's got the double line, and one of the lines said on it, written on the blueprint, says not to be tapped. Okay? Not to be tapped. Now, this particular line ran into a street perpendicular and stopped. And for the next block, there was no line. So I said, well, what happened to that line, Mr. Sabuni? He said, oh, well, you know, it went into the perpendicular street. Now, if you have a water line that's also running perpendicular, and you also had one, so there's enough water apparently in that street, why do you suddenly need a line that says not to be tapped to go into a line, make a left-hand turn, and go up the street? Now, there was a T, and there were gate valves on that T in that blueprint. Mm-hmm. So whatever is in that second line that says not to be tapped could either go flooding up the perpendicular street or not, depending on whether or not that gate valve attached to that T was on or off. Now, not to be tapped.
Hmm. That's interesting.
Well, that just sounds silly. Why run a line that you're not going to tap into?
Well, unless you've got something in it that you want to make sure people don't make the mistake of drinking from yet.
Yeah, exactly.
Huh. Well, a lot of people in America are in rural areas where they are on well water. So obviously this is a system that would only affect you. Just thinking out loud now, and you know, guide me or correct me or rebuke me or whatever. This sounds like a system that, if it were to be put into place and used, would only affect major cities.
It does sound that way, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What would be the advantage to? I mean, is it just for the purposes of hitting as many people as possible at one time, or is it because of certain types of people that tend to live in larger cities?
Well, I would say that most people live in cities at this point.
Mm-hmm. If you're trying to reduce the population, that
in a hurry.
You want to hit the cities. You wouldn't want to hit the, you know, few people living out in the farm areas. And, you know, the fact that there are other systems being set up. I mentioned earlier the existence of these, you know, quote-unquote concentration camps. Actually, Army Regulation 210-35 is calling for the setting up of civilian inmate labor camps on military bases to be run by the military. Okay, mm-hmm. That might be considered a concentration camp. I mean, depending on how these are, you know, manned and operated when they're set up. If you read the laws about 210-35, the delineations and specifications, it's pretty frightening. Basically, if there are deaths in these camps, no one's responsible. There will be no negative press coverage of what goes on in these camps. Now, if you have people living in rural areas who wouldn't be affected by T-valves, they might be affected by camps. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
we have a bunch of contingent plans, it looks like, for, you know, for different populations.
And we just saw the announcement by Kellogg Brown and Root that they were awarded a contract for the next 5 years to be prepared to build emergency camps for large populations of homeless people on a moment's notice.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that occurs to me is that with the warnings we've been hearing lately about avian flu about to hit the United States any day now and virtually guaranteed, could a system like this be used to introduce some sort of viral agent or bacterial agent that was communicable? And this is, you know, something Sharon could answer,
too. I was going to say the answer to that is yes.
We don't. As long as we don't know what's in the second line, it could be anything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the fact is that your questions have not gotten any answers to what that second line is for, or even that the acknowledgement that that second line even officially exists. Am I right?
Oh, it's just a conduit, you know. It's just going across the city. Well, then all of a sudden it runs into another line and makes a left-hand turn, and it says not to be tapped, and it's got access lines onto the first line, you know.
Mm.
We got too many lies. The blueprints themselves speak louder than the engineers who are trying to cover up what the blueprints are actually making clear.
You know, it sounds to me like there are people that are on the lower end of the chain that really maybe don't know exactly what's going on. The very fact that you're allowed to look at those blueprints tells me that.
Oh, no, the guy working the forklift, he's a good guy. I mean, he's a blue-collar guy. He's working real hard. He's proud of his work, you know, and he doesn't have any problem showing a reporter the blueprints because he doesn't think there's anything to cover up.
Yeah.
He's more concerned that the reporter is actually Osama bin Laden.
Which, of course, you are.
Well.
That's why he's still at large. Well, Janet, as
you... Oh, you blew my cover.
Oh, Rath.
Why'd you do that?
As you turn up more information, are you posting this to any specific website, or are you distributing it through a Yahoo group or anything like that where people could find out more about what you've researched and what you've discovered?
Well, I have posted some of this stuff to some of the Yahoo groups. At this point in time, I'm not doing too much of that. I did post a photograph of a blueprint and some other, you know, things, but I'm now working on a film project. Back over Christmas, I slapped together a little video called Water is a Weapon. I went up to Seattle and was Patricia Johnson Home and Will Wilson very kindly donated their public access TV time, station, editing room, et cetera, so that I could put this together. And it's just basically kind of slapped together an interview video about this, which I've sent out to a number of people. At this point in time, I am working on a film project, a documentary project with a higher standard for production values. I have a good cameraman. I've got some good equipment, and we're shooting on location around LA, and I'm attempting to make a film that is convincing enough to hopefully get more airplay than that video got. As we know, the medium can be the message, and the first interview video, it was simply an interview, you know, simply just, you know, pointing at some photographs and talking about water. But this particular film is very tightly scripted. We're doing multiple takes, and we're putting this together as professionally as possible. My training was as a print journalist. I did my graduate work actually in Missouri at University of Missouri, Columbia graduate.
Oh, yeah, sure. Okay. Excellent school for that, yeah.
Yeah. And I never took a broadcast course in my life. Everything was about print. So this is a new venture for me, and I'm attempting, you know, to get some assistance, you know, to put this together so that it can get more dissemination and more people can look at this and realize that we have a problem.
Now, are you thinking of DVD distribution, or are you going to try to actually get airplay on this?
Well, I got some airplay on that first 28-minute DVD that we put together up in Seattle. It got airplay in Seattle. It got airplay on the west side of L.A. and I believe in some other parts of the country, too. But I think that if I can get this put together well enough that I could get it into some film festivals and possibly on Sundance. So I'm trying to shoot high and keep my fingers crossed.
Well, we'll keep you in prayer as you proceed in this project. I'm sure you will attract notice, and if there's, you know, anything that we can do to be of assistance, you know, please let us know, and certainly let us know when your project is ready, and we'll do what we can to let people know about this. We'll also post links to the pieces that you've written and to the pictures that you've taken, the scanned photos, the scanned letters and faxes that you received from the government officials that you mentioned in the show notes and on our website so that people can investigate and look at the evidence for themselves. This is not something where we're asking people to take our word or your word for it, and I think it was wise to provide the documentation and the evidence so that people can look at these things for themselves and see the evidence. And when your film comes out, we'll certainly look forward to seeing that and examining the evidence and the work that you've done in order to collect it.
Oh, yeah. Janet, if any of our listeners would like to contact you, would you have an email address, or would you want them to write to us and then have us forward it on to you?
I would be glad to give my email address. The best one to use is Janet C. Phelan at yahoo.com. Phelan is spelled P as in popcorn, H as in Helen, E-L-A-N as in Nancy. That's Janet C. Phelan at yahoo.com. And I will attempt to answer all questions. And if anybody has any, you know, supplementary information as well, please send it over.
We will certainly encourage them to do that. Janet, thank you for your time today. And, boy, especially thank you for the work that you've put into researching this very disturbing news. The Public Extermination Project is the name of the article. And, again, we'll put a link to it in the show notes. And, Janet, we look forward to talking with you again soon.
God bless. Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, that wraps up the interview with Janet Phelan, and, you know, we want to have her back. So as she continues to investigate this issue, we will have her back. And we've spoken to her on the phone since then. I think we mentioned that yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And we still continue to get email from her. So as we continue to chat, we'll definitely let you know what's going on with it.
Yeah. And we do have some good news to report, a rather well, ugly and frightening story from Tennessee earlier today appears to have had at least some good news come out in just the last few minutes while we record this.
Yeah, in fact, it was the top story as of this evening on Watch Your News, the story of a young pastor who had been found dead in his Selma, Tennessee home. His wife and young daughters were missing, and they have now been found in Alabama. According to a story here, it says the wife and three young daughters of a pastor found shot to death in their Selma, Tennessee home have been found in Orange Beach, Alabama, according to the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation. Mary Farmer Winkler, age 32, and her girls are safe, according to the TBI alert issued Thursday night. And authorities had been searching throughout Thursday for the family after the body of Matthew Brian Winkler, age 31, was found late Wednesday in his bedroom by 4th Street Church of Christ members. Now, the congregation members became concerned when Matthew missed the prayer services at the church on Wednesday night, where he served as a pastor for only about a year. The Tennessee Bureau of Investigation issued an Amber Alert, which, of course, we had on the site.
Mm-hmm.
And the three children are Patricia, age 8, Mary Alice, age 6, and little Brianna, only age 1. So we are praising God that they have been found. And we just pray that whatever they have been through, that God will put his arms around them and that they'll be able to rest well tonight. And we pray for those kids because they've got a lot to go through. Whatever they've already been through now,
yeah.
You know, it's hard to say why they were in Alabama, what exactly happened. I'm sure that'll be untangled over the next few days, but really pray for this family.
Absolutely. We appreciate you listening tonight, and we welcome your comments. You can send them by email to radio@peeringintodarkness.com.
And we always welcome your thoughts at the forums. Forum, you can join up. It's free. It's peeringintodarkness.com/forum.
Until tomorrow, I'm Derek Gilbert.
I'm Sharon Gilbert, and I'm looking at the gazelle. I'm ready for action.
Thanks for listening to PID Radio.
Bye, everybody. Gonna step up to the microphone. Say it loud and clear. A better day is coming soon to get us out.